Welcome to the Engaged Midwife Podcast. This is Kara.
And this is Missy. Welcome back. Missy. Hi.
It's fun to chat with you again today.
Yeah, we're just, updating ourselves on the Grammys, which was super fun.
Yeah, and the sun is shining here. I don't know how it is in Cincinnati, but...
The sun is shining here, but in like T-minus 24 hours, I'm going to be back in the Florida sunshine. So I am ready to escape again the cold, gray disgustingness that is Midwest winter.
I don't know what the temps are in Florida, but it's supposed to be 70 here by the end of the week, which just blows my mind because that means within a few weeks' time, we've gone from negative temperatures to 70, and that is just bizarre.
It is bizarre. I'm worried about the state of the environment that we are swinging that much 80 degrees in temperature. And
well, let's move away from that because that is a deep conversation and it's hard not to feel like there's like existential dread coming. But
I was like, we are purging. That's what we do in the winter in the Steck household is we reorganize and purge. And so I am on a binge of like getting rid of the things. This does not bring me joy. It must go. And then I was also having this existential crisis about, should this go to recycling? Like, how do we recycle this thing? Like, we can't just throw this in the trash. Right. And Bob's like, why all of a sudden you have a conscience? And I'm like, I've always had a conscience. It's just like,
amount of effort versus how bad it'll make me feel.
Yeah. Like throwing away sometimes a soda can does not feel nearly as bad as like, you know, throwing away a small electronic device or a small kitchen appliance or glass jars and bottles, like glass things. It's a long time in a landfill, but I digress.
I really, really enjoy taking the glass to the glass recycling place. If you ever have anger, glass recycling is real cool.
Oh, it could kind of be like a little office space situation.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Wildly therapeutic.
It is. It really is. I have a funny story about my 9 weeks of bed rest back in 2008. And I finally had the time to do some reading. And I read An Inconvenient Truth, which was Al Gore's book about the environment. And my husband came home to me sobbing hysterically because we were bringing a child into this world and we weren't taking care of it. And we've been recycling ever since.
I mean, I do love that. I think that's fantastic. And I do think that the glass recycling may be something that I actually need to, that I need to consider. Like I need to put like a bin in the garage that's specifically for glass, like bottles, candles. Like my husband's addicted to Yankee candles. He will not tell you. Maybe he will. He's pretty forthcoming with his addiction. But glass candle jars and my boys are addicted to root beer. So all of those kinds of things,
all those things, pasta, sauce, wine,
maybe off the wine and maybe some more of the wine, maybe a little more of the wine.
Anyway. Yeah. It just takes a little bit more effort for glass because we have to take ours somewhere.
Yeah, we would have to take it too.
But I do. I just have a bin right outside the garage door and put it there.
All right. Topic of the day.
Cervical cancer screening.
I love that.
Yeah.
I was just having a conversation in the context of the board exam yesterday with someone. And I said, we all do cervical cancer screening and we all look up the results if it's not normal. I cannot tell you. I mean, maybe somebody with a photographic memory does not look this up. But what I was saying and the point of this conversation was like, we are all looking it up, and I would have so much more respect for an exam that said, here's the result, here's the guideline. Do you know how to interpret this guideline correctly?
Well, the interesting thing is in 2019, ASCCP, which is the organization that puts out most guidance about what to do with our cervical cancer screening result, has all the algorithms. It really became very personalized because it's an individual person's likelihood of developing cervical cancer based on all of their past results. So it's not even just like this one-time pap test result. It really is a personalized risk now. And I am so thankful there is an app for that.
Yeah, this is one of the apps that we pay for. It's one of the ones that we say all the time, like, if you're going to pay for an app, don't pay for all of them, but this is a good one to pay for.
Yeah. So I think what we'll do today, if that's okay with you, is we'll talk about some of the history. We'll talk about, you know, cervical cancer incidence over time, some of those different things, but also how to interpret the results, what might we see on some of our different results that we get back on these screening tests, and kind of go from there.
Right. So I think that's a great idea. What do we know? Like, how long has it been that we've been like actually screening for cervical cancer? Do you know?
It's kind of crazy. Yeah. So the first test, why we for many, 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 many years called it the Pap test or the Pap smear. Although a lot of people have not smeared in a very long time.
There are midwives who don't even understand that why it was called a smear.
Yeah. I actually had a clinic. Well, anyway, we'll talk more about that. But we used to smear the cells on a glass slide and send it off to look under a microscope. But anyway, Dr. Papanikolaou was a Greek physician back in the 1920s. And he originally published a paper along with an American physician in like 1941. And they really talked about it being a type of uterine cancer that they were screening for, but they drew out what the results would look like of different types of cell changes before someone developed cancer and then when they had cancer. And that was the initial screening test. And so when that came out in the 1920s and then really pushed in the 1940s, screening started to become more normal over the years and cervical cancer incidence dropped dramatically.
Let's talk a little bit about naming, because this is hot on people's minds in terms of, especially in like when we talk about medicine, right? And how we have named things and we've named them for people. Lots of things are named for people, right? Body parts, procedures, right? Medical instruments. Correct. Mm-hmm. So this is another one that we call it a PAP because it's named after a person.
A man.
And it's the, you know, if you want to get away from the idea of calling something by a person or a patriarchal name, we can just call it a cervical cancer screening and that is okay.
Yeah. I think it is important to understand that patients know it as a PAP. The public knows it as a PAP. I mean, I think we've done a pretty good job of educating people about this type of test, but ourselves as professionals, as we talk about it, when we are in the literature, that sort of thing, starting kind of moving towards cervical cancer screening makes way more sense. And it is actually what we're doing, where so many people think that if you use a speculum, you're doing a PAP. Those two have been linked together. That's not actually what we're doing. You could do lots of different things with a speculum. So calling it what it is, naming what we're doing, I think it's a good idea.
I also find that interesting because I get a lot of like, whenever I use a speculum, I'm always clear about why. Why am I putting a speculum in your vagina? What it is for and what it is not for, what I am doing and what I'm not doing, right? Because lots of, I think, especially younger people think they've gone to the doctor and somebody's put a speculum in, and then that means that they've had a cervical cancer screening, which is not true.
Oftentimes not true. Yes.
They could have just had an STD screen, or they could have been checked for vaginitis. There could have been a million reasons that they were looking in there using a speculum, but not doing a cervical cancer screening.
And I mean, you know, I'm not someone to ever say never, but I would venture to guess that almost never has someone had a cervical cancer screening in the emergency department, but many people think that they have.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes. I also find it really interesting the amount of like in a community hospital where you don't have like an OBGYN service, the amount of like EM docs that are putting speculums in people's vaginas. And I'm like, I know you've seen that done, but was it A, necessary, and B, relevant, and C, did you really know what you were looking for / seeing?
Right.
So
back in 2012, the major professional organizations, the USPSTF, which you guys hear us talk about all the time, all of them kind of came together. And it was the first time that we had everyone agreeing that we should start PAP testing or cervical cancer screening at age 21, and that we do not need to do it yearly on everyone, which was such a great change, and probably has protected some people's fertility, has, you know, helped with less procedures on cervixes, all of those different things. But that major change came back in 2012, which has been during our careers. For new midwives, they're like, God, that was like, over a decade ago. But it still has not really become like totally accepted practice everywhere in the U.S. I still know so many people that are doing too many cervical cancer screenings, but this was then updated in 2019 with new algorithms of what to do with those results.
I will say that I think part of the reason that practices have continued to do yearly cervical cancer screening is because insurance companies are still paying for it. And that was kind of like the word on the street is, well, if the insurance companies are still going to pay for it, I'm still going to do it. Yes. Okay. From a revenue standpoint, no, not okay. From an evidence-based practice standpoint.
Well, and understanding that there's risk anytime you do a test, you know, and that the risk may not be financial, but the risk could be emotional health, stress, anxiety, additional procedures that had to be done, all of those different things.
Right. I think that the burden of treatment and diagnosis and those kinds of things that might come with some like yearly papping that isn't going to really make a long term, right? Is it what's in the best interest of the patient? So
let me tell you just a little bit about how common cervical cancer is, and some information about in the U.S. versus worldwide, and then we'll dive into a bit more about the top test results and so forth.
Great.
So cervical cancer in the United States is predicted that in 2024, there will be about 14,000 cases of invasive cervical cancer in the U.S., and that about 4,500 women will die of cervical cancer, which is a relatively low number when you think about the population of the U.S., but it's still way too high for a cancer that is so slow growing. And cervical cancer is usually diagnosed in women between the ages of 35 and 44, although there's a broad range of ages. It's rarely to almost never seen in people under age 20.
But now that's true because we're not screening until 21, right?
Right. Well, and this is what's really cool is the cervical cancer incidence has decreased by more than half from the 1970s to the mid-2000s, and then it's pretty much stayed the same since the mid-2000s. Although the rates in people aged 20 to 24 has declined by over 10% just in the 20s. And they think that that's probably because of our good vaccination with HPV vaccines. Really incredible.
Get the people vaccinated.
Exactly. The cancer death rate has also dropped by more than half since the 70s. But one of the things that we talk about is when there are disparities, and the death rate in Black women and Native American women is about 65% higher than it is in white women. And that is not because of biological difference. That is disparities based on social determinants of health and racism in the healthcare system and all of the things.
Okay. What? I mean, we could go on a whole thing just about what you just said, right?
Oh yeah. Let's not open that can of worms today, but it's important to note.
So we were just, I want to like take the side road that you opened up with vaccinations, right? Mm-hmm. So we have HPV vaccinations now, and HPV is the cause of 90% of cervical cancer.
Yes.
So when we talk about vaccinations, many moons ago when that vaccine just came out, it was only for girls and it was only from one age to another, right? We have been able to, over the last several years, very much expand that to not just biologically female people, but also males, and expanded the age range by a lot.
Yeah. So it's really clear that age 9 to 26 is approved, but it's actually encouraged up to age 45 for both sexes.
Yeah. And, you know, the interesting part, like I have sons, right? All of them were vaccinated. Mostly because HPV is something that is wildly asymptomatic and people don't know that they have it. And then what happens in some cases is you don't know you have it, you give it to someone. And even if that's in the context of like a monogamous relationship or a marriage, and, you know, you end up with this, you know, STD that is causing, that's causative of cervical cancer. I just think it leads to a lot of long-term, not just physical health like repercussions, but just emotional repercussions as well.
Yeah. And you're exactly right. HPV that we're concerned with the cancer causing strains is that high risk HPV. There are a couple of different types, but 16 and 18 are our most cancer causing. And there aren't symptoms, and it's not just the cervix. It's, anal cancer, penile cancer, head and neck cancers. It's just really incredible how HPV is related. And so if we can prevent that, we should.
Right. And there aren't, the vaccines never come without risk, right? And I think we would be amiss to just not say like, hey, vaccinate everybody for HPV. However, we do know that this is a very low risk vaccination and with a high benefit.
Yes. Ideal age for administration is age 11 or 12 in both sexes. And if someone starts the series before age 15, it's only 2 injections. If they start it at 15 or after, it's 3 injections.
Also, like when we think about, I know you gave us those numbers on cervical cancer, like how many people will be diagnosed versus how many people will die. It's also important to know that cervical cancer is still like in the top 5 of cancer deaths for women.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think that is something to consider. And breast cancer is up there. I think all of the things that we deal with, right? Somebody teasingly said the other day that if it's not covered by a bikini, I don't take care of it. And I was like, but a uterus doesn't have to be covered by a bikini. But they were like, you get the point. And I was like, I get the point. But all of these like gynecologic things, breast cancer, cervical cancer, like they just, they fall under our purview. So I think we have to be particularly, we have to pay particular attention to these kinds of things in our patient populations.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so with our cervical cancer screening, we are sampling some cells from the surface of the cervix, and we're hoping to get that transformation zone. So where the cells on the cervix transition from squamous to epithelial, columnar, then that is, we want that transformation zone. And I think it's interesting to know that like 90% of cervical cancers are a squamous cell carcinoma. About 10% are an adenocarcinoma, and then some other types are out there, but mostly these are squamous cell abnormalities.
So when we are doing cervical cancer screen. So again, the reminder, right, about screening versus diagnostic tests. So screening tests, right, are cervical cancer screening. It's cells from the cervix that we're looking for abnormalities in the cells that we obtain. It'd be like the same as having a screening mammogram, right? Or or a screening DEXA. So what we're looking for then is there a reason for us to either follow up on that screening or do a diagnostic test, which in this case, I also love the Latin colposcopy, right? Colpo means cervix, oscopy means to look at, right? People want to say that colposcopy is diagnostic. It's not the actual colposcopy that's diagnostic in this case. It's the biopsy.
Right.
So I think words are important, right? and understanding, like, you may, for example, in pregnancy, just do a colposcopy where you're just looking at the cervix, putting vinegar on it, and deciding if there are changes that you want to watch or biopsy after pregnancy, or if there are enough changes that warrant biopsy at the time.
Right.
Versus I'm actually having you come in because I plan to do a colposcopy with a biopsy and an endocervical curettage, right? So,
right.
And we can talk a little bit more about like how we get to diagnosis, but I think that as you are talking to patients and understanding cervical cancer screening, that you have to like really sort of dig in to what the meaning of those things are that we are doing.
Yeah. So cervical cancer screening is cytology or cell pathology. So exactly what you said, looking at cells. And biopsy is histopathology, and that's that tissue sample. Similar, you mentioned like a mammogram and a fine needle aspiration, kind of the same difference between the two.
Good reminders, I think, for people who are like, oh, but I've been doing this test. And I'm like, but is that screening or diagnostic, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So you will sometimes see different terms thrown around, and I want to just mention them really quickly. If these are not familiar to you, go spend some more time diving deeper into it. But when we talk about cytology, so our cervical cancer screening, we're thinking in terms of low-grade squamous intraepithelial lesions, so LSIL, or high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesion, HSIL. We can also see atypical squamous cell abnormalities and those sorts of things on our results, but that is talking about the things that we may see on a cervical cancer screening or PAP test. When we talk about things that we can see that are like CIN, so cervical intraepithelial neoplasia, those are the results that we will get from a colposcopy with biopsy. And we can have like CIN1, which is considered mild dysplasia, CIN2 is moderate, and then severe being CIN3. CIN2 and 3 are sometimes combined together. And I just want to make sure that everybody understands that when we talk about those things, that is from biopsy.
Will they ever see on a screening test cannot exclude as language?
Yeah. So one of the squamous cell abnormalities is ASCH, ASC-H, and that is an atypical squamous cell abnormality, cannot exclude a high-grade lesion, and that is more concerning than ASCUS or ASC-US, which is an atypical squamous cell of undetermined significance. With that, usually we will do high-risk HPV testing. We would for the ASCH as well, but if you cannot exclude a high-grade lesion, this is most often always going to go on to further testing with colposcopy and biopsy.
Okay, I'm going to make a statement and you tell me whether or not you agree.
Oh dear. Okay.
Most ASCUS PAPs, the next step is to repap. I didn't say all, but most.
When you already have an HPV result, or
if you don't have an HPV, or if you're HPV negative, ASCUS almost always means repap.
I think agree with that nowadays. Yes, that repapping is one option. I really would want to know my high-risk HPV status, and hopefully my PAP had reflex to already give me that result. But yeah, generally ASCUS is not as concerning as ASCH or some of the other findings that we can see.
Right. I am trying to get at the idea that like if you see an ASCUS PAP, that a lot of the guidelines in ASCCP will tell you that repapping is an option.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I also strongly believe that in the last 10 years, we have done less colposcopy because the guidelines have gotten a little more, a little less stringent on who has to have a colposcopy.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be routine that if anybody had ascus, they automatically went for colposcopy, right? And right. So you're correct. And I think that some of that depends on the age of the patient. It depends if they're pregnant or not. It depends on what their previous results have been, which is so great because we can individualize recommendations for people.
You just segued like so perfectly into some of the recommendations. So one of the things I think we're not going to do today is to just go through all of the guidelines. I don't think it's necessary because I think that the things that we're going to do as midwives are, we are going to do cervical cancer screening. We are going to interpret results. In most cases, ascus are low grade. We're going to make recommendations that patients either need to be repapped or need to have a colposcopy. And if they have something higher than that, you're likely going to consult with one of your collaborating physicians. For example, if you do a screening and somebody comes back with a high grade lesion, you are going to send them, right? To say like, hey, we probably need to do a colposcopy. Colposcopy is not in the guidelines for basic midwifery practice. I went to the ASCCP training, so I can do colposcopy and biopsy. I actually really appreciated that in terms of continuity of care for my patients when they needed to have a colposcopy. But you have lots of people around you. If that's not something that you're interested in, it was a fairly hard certification, I feel like, but yes,
it takes lots of observation, lots of cases, lots of training.
Correct. And so I think that just understanding that it's not in our scope without some additional training. But our big job is to just understand what the initial screening test says and know what to do with that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we mentioned that the guidelines were updated in 2019, and you all should know that ACOG did put out some clinical guidance in 2020 that was also supporting those changes and kind of summarizing what the major changes had been. So you can find that on the ACOG website. I think the biggest thing, yep. The biggest change was exactly what we said of really the recommendations are based on risk, and it's the risk of developing CIN3 or greater by looking at their past results, their current results, their history of getting tested, all of those different things, and predicting. It's built into the app. It will calculate a risk for you of what that person's likelihood of developing CIN3 is in the next few years and basing the recommendation on that. It's pretty cool.
I love that. I just like risk-based screening, right? And you and I talk a lot about this. Like, whose guidelines are we going to follow based on how do we feel about our risk for screening, right?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, we talk about that with colonoscopy, right? With mammography, with like all the things that we consider screening and what our risks are. So I think it's great to like understand that risk-based assessment is beneficial to a lot of people. I never have to have a cervical cancer screening again because I have no cervix. Now, back in the day, even if you'd had a full a hysterectomy and you didn't have a cervix, they were still doing what?
We would vaginal, pass the cuff.
Yeah, vaginal cuff cervical cancer screening. I'm like, come on, man.
It's so crazy to think back to what we used to do.
It is crazy. So can we walk through the ACOG clinical practice guideline about screening and what some of their recommendations are?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's do that. So I think the first thing that we were just talking about is that their recommendations for ACOG are based on risk and not results, right?
Right. Right.
So it's the combination of what's currently happening and what their history is as to what the next steps are.
Yes. And so two people of the same age with a different history might have different recommendations, even if they have the same current PAP result, or someone that's younger could have a very different result than someone that's older, even if they had the same PAP history, because it's personalized to them.
I also want to add something about HPV here, because the next recommendation from ACOG is that you can defer colposcopy on some patients. Something that I think I am very vocal about when I talk to patients about things like HPV is you can have a positive HPV screening, and in 2 years, it could be negative.
Right.
Our bodies do an amazing job of clearing this sometimes. And so if you have been previously HPV positive, you can, in a future screening, come up HPV negative. That's not a mistake. That is your body doing what it needs to do to potentially clear HPV and have you have a negative result.
Yeah, your immune system doing what it's supposed to do.
Which is awesome.
Totally awesome.
Like, as a sort of expansion on what ACOG says, is that, like, if you have a minor screening abnormality and maybe you have HPV with a super low risk of getting CIN3, you don't necessarily need to have a colposcopy. You can have another screening and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that they talk about the idea of the high risk HPV result helping to kind of triage what you should do. As well as like the idea of reflex for high risk HPV versus co-testing, meaning that we're going to test for HPV at the same time as the cervical cancer screening. And those two ideas may be different based on age, but it is nice to know that that can, that that HPV result can really help you.
I also think that in ACOG's guidelines, it also tells you that there are some times where we're just going to treat without a colpo.
If it's a worrisome enough result.
And I think that goes back to what I was just saying, though. Like, our job is to look at the results and know what to do, right? Either send them for a colpo or refer them to somebody because you want to do an expedited treatment with or without colposcopy. You don't have to make that decision. You just have to know when to send somebody for treatment if you think that they've got like a big, bad, ugly, you know, cytology change.
Yeah. One of the other things that we have in the recommendations isn't necessarily applicable to midwives, but it's good to know excisional treatment is preferred to like ablation, burning, heating, you know, that kind of idea. And so if you're referring your patient for a procedure, it's most likely that they would have an excision of the lesion rather than some of the kind of older techniques.
Right. And that's LEAP. So if you've heard the acronym for LEAP, that's loop excision. I worked with a doctor who did these in the office quite frequently. Yeah. It's a cautery like loop, right? That excises the part of the cervix. Now that does not come without risk. That has all kinds of associated things in terms of shortening the cervical length and whether or not you think you've gotten, you know, all of the parts of how deep is the lesion into the cervical tissue. There's a whole lot of things, again, in not in our scope, but good to have some awareness of.
Yeah. Yeah. And you kind of mentioned this already, but the next thing is that if someone has like a CIN1, so they have a mild dysplasia, we can observe. We don't have to move to excisional procedures for someone with CIN1.
Which is a big change. I feel like back in the day, we were doing a lot of procedures on a lot of people that now we would say, hey, I'm just going to watch that thing.
Well, we've learned a lot more over the years for exactly the thing that you mentioned earlier, is that the immune system is pretty incredible and can do some amazing things. So let's see if the body can take care of it on its own without us altering the cervix, changing it, having impacts on fertility, those kinds of things.
Agreed. So positive HPV is on their guidelines, right? If you have a positive primary HPV screening, reflex testing should be ordered. And I think almost all now when we do HPV screening has like a reflex ordered. Maybe not. And I'm sure we'll get emails that say, we don't do reflex screening. Well, if it's positive, you should be doing reflex screening.
Yeah. And this is also mentioning primary HPV screening. So like in place of a cervical, like our typical cervical cancer screen, there's one option that you can do primary HPV. Either way, they're saying you should reflex to also then having cytology versus if you have a cytology abnormality, you should reflex to a high-risk HPV. Just know that those are different, but you're exactly right. Reflexing, if there's any abnormality, should just be common practice.
What else does ACOG have to say? 25 years of testing, right? But let's think about this. Every 3 years for 25 years, that gets you to about what? Like eight cervical cancer screenings, barring anything being abnormal. I like that number, right? Because
if you've had an abnormality of high grade CIN2 or CIN3 or an adenocarcinoma in situ. So that additional 25 years and those eight cervical cancer screenings is if you've had a major abnormality.
Right.
You don't have to test as frequently if you haven't.
Correct. So this is such a change because back in the day, you started getting cervical cancer screenings as soon as you were either sexually active or if you wanted birth control, because God forbid you wanted birth control and you weren't having sex, because that just wasn't like a thing. So right. We did cervical cancer screening starting at like age 16, age 18, whatever that looks like, every single year until you turned, I don't know, 60. I still have these little old women who want to come in and get a cervical cancer screening. But I mean, think about that, even from 20 to 60, every single year, 40 years, having a cervical cancer screening 40 times in your lifetime. It's the only screening test where we used to do it every single year for every single patient, basically from the time they started their period until they went through menopause or longer. So
we were part of that. I remember my 20s. Like,
yes, we resemble all of that. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's just crazy to think now that you even, and in the absence of abnormalities, you can go 5 years without having a pap screening and you're not starting until you're 21. I mean, that even takes it to less than eight times in a particular lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Interesting. The other recommendation that I find really fascinating is that they do talk about if you don't have the capability to do HPV testing at all, you can do just cytology, but cytology isn't as sensitive and specific. And so you need to do it more frequently. So if you only have cytology, you only have the traditional cervical cancer screening test, you would do that yearly. But when we can add that reflex to the high-risk HPV, or we can co-test with HPV, then we don't need to do that as frequently. We could do it every 3 years or every 5 years, depending on age.
I mean, I worked in like a health department. So one of my practices partnered with the health department. And so we went to these health departments in these really like rural areas once a week to just do gynecology, right? To just like do cervical cancer screening and birth control visits and STI checks and those kinds of things. And in those settings, we only did actual cervical cancer smears, like no thin prep. Like we actually sent slides away and we didn't have the availability to do HPV testing in those kinds of settings. So, I mean, if you're, I don't know because I haven't worked in one of those settings many, many, many moons. However, I do know that there are probably places in the US where providers are seeing patients and they don't have the availability to do some of these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I am one of the safety net clinics that I worked at, until just a few years ago, we were still doing the smears and we did not have HPV testing, but it became a situation where those patients are often lost to follow up, those kinds of things. So it was just going to be better for us to take the cost of doing liquid-based cytology where we could do the reflex and had better results because we didn't have to have them come back for another sample or those kinds of things. It's really nice to have the capability to do HPV testing. And I think it's more widespread now.
I have a couple asterisks to add to this conversation before we wrap it up. One is Affordable Care Act makes cervical cancer screening something that every woman should be able to have. So
as long as they are insured. Yes.
Yes. As long as they are insured. And two, there is another set of guidelines. You and I are always stuck in this like caveat of there are other guidelines.
There are. Yeah.
That's the American Cancer Society guidelines. They are very different than what ASCCP says.
They are.
And so I think it's important wherever you work to know what guidelines you're following, right? I was having this conversation about gestational diabetes the other day. And I was like, this patient's not a diabetic, not by either sets of criteria, right? Because I always have to be clear, like, are we using Carpenter and Kustan? Are we using National Diabetes Data Group? Because I don't know. But the same thing is like with cervical cancer screening, you have to know what guideline that your practice guidelines or that you're following so that you know that you're doing the right thing. I will say, and I may be wrong, that most people are using ASCCP.
I think that's true. ACOG, USPSTF, ASCCP agree with cervical cancer screening being the primary test, where the American Cancer Society talks about using a primary HPV test as the major screening. And so those are different.
Really different.
And most of the time we're used to starting at age 21 with most of the guidelines. And the American Cancer Society says you can start at 25 and test every 5 years.
Yeah. So knowing what I think where you're living in terms of guidelines is just really relevant as you're, you know, doing these kinds of tests. And if you are a like ambulatory care based provider, I mean, you're probably doing a lot of cervical cancer screening. I mean, I saw a lot of B patients, but I mean, I did a lot of annuals, and I also did a lot of talking when the guidelines have come out about like, you don't need a PAP this year. And they're like, but I'm here. Can I have my PAP? And I'm like, but you don't need a PAP. And now the insurance companies, I think, are coming around to the fact that women don't need them. So we have to be careful about when we do these kinds of screenings to ensure that they will be covered. As the guidelines have now changed, I think they're getting further and further away from covering just like blindly covering things that aren't indicated.
Yeah. One of the things that you mentioned, I want to also have my little asterisk on, and then we can probably wrap this up, is that, you know, I remember historically getting some cervical cancer screening results back, and it would say like cellular changes consistent with candidiasis or something like that. And I remember very vividly being told PAP test or a cervical cancer screen is not testing for vaginitis. It is looking for dysplasia. And so don't treat just based on your cervical cancer results. You would want to call the patient and bring them back in, whatever you decided to do in your office setting. I will put a caveat on that, that now with the liquid-based cytology, there is a test that you can check that would add your gonorrhea and chlamydia testing, as well as your vaginitis screen on that same PAP or cervical cancer screening specimen. And that can give you the results. And that's because we've had changes in our vaginitis screening that we now have probes available and testing available. Our gonorrhea and chlamydia doesn't have to be just a swab. It can be a liquid base. So just know that those are out there. It's a different checkbox on your order form. But you can get vaginitis results on some cervical cancer screening tests now.
But I love the reminder that we're not supposed to just be blindly treating like, hey, by the way, your PAP showed this thing and we're going to treat it. Because I also think that that is a mindset change, right? Because I think in the past that clinicians have done that. Anyway, I think that it's a good reminder to be like, hey, don't do that unless your patient's symptomatic, right? Maybe they were symptomatic when they came in and you already have treated them and you're like, oh, it's good to know that I already did that thing. And that it was also on my cervical cancer screening. So,
yeah, this has been a really great conversation, Missy. I have appreciated the review myself. I appreciate thinking about what this means for my own cancer screening as well as my daughter's. And just, I love that we are getting a little bit more personalized care, and that we are being really good stewards of what tests we have available. And we're not just willy-nilly doing things to patients, which can increase our risk.
Exactly. So thanks for joining us for this episode of the Engaged Midwife Podcast. We can't wait to talk to you again.
Take care.